Hi, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to multi-award-winning journalist and author Paul Daly. Paul worked for 2 decades as a foreign correspondent for Fairfax newspapers and national affairs editor for The Bulletin. He has won 2 Walkley Awards and the National Press Club Award for Excellence in Press Gallery Journalism. His essays have appeared in Meanjin and Griffith Review, and his best-selling book, Bathsheba, was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Prize for History. Paul is the author of the football history memoir, Collingwood, A Love Story, the political thriller, Challenge, and is in the final stages of his second novel, set in northeast Arnhem Land. Paul currently writes Postcolonial, a column for The Guardian about Australian national identity, history, and Indigenous culture. Paul, welcome to Archive Fever, or Archives Anonymous, as we like to call it.
Glad to be here.
Paul, we'll get back to your genre-crossing writing career in a moment, but I'd like to start by asking you if you can remember how you first got the research bug.
I first got the research bug definitely as a journalist. You know, there was nothing quite like covering the big story, being the eyes and ears of a place and an event. But when I wasn't doing that, I was always drawn to the documentary, to the paper trail. I just found that the biggest, boldest stories that had the biggest bang revolved around a piece of paper, a cabinet submission, if you could get someone to give you that, or a secret cable, which was always kind of incriminating of, you know, a government's diplomatic position and its duplicity. So, yeah, I always went for that sort of stuff. I spent 20 years doing that, really.
And as a journalist, were you trained in archival research?
Not at all. There was really no such thing as journalism training when I was a baby journalist. I came straight from a pretty general arts degree, and it was kind of sink or swim. You kind of had to figure out what to look for. And I was kind of lucky or unlucky in a way that I was posted to Canberra pretty early, and it was evident to me that the big stories in Canberra were about exposing duplicity, lies, and the best way to do that was to get a denial from a politician, preferably a prime minister or a minister, and then prove them wrong with a piece of paper that had their name on it.
So it was evidence. You were in search of evidence.
Yeah, I was in search of evidence. Yeah, absolutely.
What did that search feel like for you? What does archive fever feel like for you?
It is an absolute addiction. There's no doubt about that. And for me, it was coupled with the excitement of the reaction to a big story. So I equate kind of the discovery of that golden document, that piece of paper that tells us something we didn't know, that incriminates someone, that illuminates something about the past, as the gotcha moment in journalism and maybe the gotcha moment in history too.
So I guess, unlike a lot of historians, when you have your eureka moment, you know someone's going down.
Well, in the olden days, when I was, you know, a full-time journo, that was what it was about. It was about exposing an untruth, exposing a wrong. So, yeah, so, I mean, would they necessarily go down? Well, one guy was charged by the Australian Federal Police because of a story I did that involved documents, and it changed the balance of power in the Senate. So that was pretty big. That was a result. I guess in terms of what I do now, it's a little bit different. No one's going to get charged by the AFP, but we are going to find out, or I'm going to find out something I didn't know. And the excitement is the same. It doesn't feel hugely different to me.
Is it still adrenaline fueled?
Totally. Totally. It's just a slower process, though, and a much more considered process than the chase used to be in journalism. And bearing in mind that in journalism, there's this hyper competitiveness too, particularly in a place like the Press Gallery, where everyone wants that increment of the story or the big story that's going to blow the system up. It's a lot more considered in terms of what I do these days and what I've done since I stopped being a full-time journo, which was maybe 10 years ago.
And what led you to make that transition from political journalism into more kind of historical writing and commentary?
That's a really big life question for me, but it's a good one and it's a fair one. Having worked full-time as a journalist for, you know, 20-something years kind of here and overseas and travelling a lot, particularly the last kind of 4 years of my full-time journalism career, which were as national affairs editor for the Bulletin magazine, now defunct because Jamie Packer decided he wanted to put his money into casinos rather than media, I just felt like the stories were becoming perennial. I felt like I was putting a lot of effort into trying to make a difference, but that things were not actually changing. The system wasn't changing. Democracy wasn't improving. And I actually got into journalism to write. I never got into journalism to become a journalist. The thing was, I actually had a pretty good time doing it and I was quite good at it. And it was very seductive. I stayed for a long, long time. What changed was that, yeah, Jamie Packer pulled the plug. Private Equity took over the Bulletin, which was, you know, at that point the oldest literary magazine in the country. And I kind of fell on the check. I'd always wanted to write books and that kind of leveraged me out. It gave me some money to fall back on and an opportunity that I took.
Because that's when you went to write your book, Beersheba, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Why did you choose that topic? Why were you drawn to military history and military archives?
I was drawn to that story because as a journalist, I'd spent a lot of time with the military on exercise and on operation, East Timor, for example, and Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands and later in the Middle East. And as a young journalist, as a very young journalist on a local paper, I'd come across a guy, an old guy, who had apparently been in the charge of Beersheba. He was a 90-something-year-old former light horseman. And I wrote this story about him, having interviewed him, in which he recalled vividly the charge of the light horse at Beersheba and his participation in it in October 1917. So I thought this would be a great book, not as a military history, which I'm not a military historian, but I really wanted to kind of dig into the stories and the, I guess, the appropriations of this story by everyone from, you know, Zionists and Christians to the Israel-Australia lobby. So I went over there and spent a lot of time researching the terrain, spent a ton of time in archives in Australia and the UK and in Israel, and then went back to my initial story. And I realised that this old guy could not have possibly have been in this charge of Beersheba. So it was kind of an examination of my own memory as well and my own experience as a reporter. And it was kind of part memoir too, which a lot of my stuff is. You know, my dad had just died at the time and I was grieving. So it's kind of a story about fathers and sons as well, which a lot of my work ends up being, not necessarily intentionally.
Paul, you said that the plug was pulled in a way on your career as a journalist. Did journalism itself change as well? Was there less room in the 24-hour news cycle to be able to pursue the sort of stories or at least the sort of research that you wanted to do?
It changed very quickly after the Bulletin folded in, I think it was Australia Day 2008 was the last edition. At the time it folded, I sort of had this rarefied job. I was writing 3,000-4,000-word pieces on politics, security stuff, quite sort of philosophical stuff on leadership too, really deep dive, heavily researched stories that were kind of a joy to write and they were polished in terms of the writing too. We used to file for the internet like once a week back then. So I had an internet column and it was 500 words a week and it was kind of a drag, but something you kind of had to do. Around about that time, you know, Convergence really went ahead with a fury and I don't think I could have coped in that new environment. I mean, I could have done it physically, but I'd have had to have kind of switched my part of my brain off, I think. And I'm still quite a slow writer when it comes to the long form stuff. The other part of the answer to your question is, I think, you know, the market has been so saturated with that quick turnover, very sort of pointy end news stuff that there was a real kind of slow death of slow journalism. But there's a massive resurgence in it. So now I work largely online for Guardian, but they've got no qualms about running a 4,000 or 5,000 word piece of mine that's heavily researched. And the beauty of that too is that it can make it into Guardian Weekly or the, you know, the printed product in London. And The literary mags in Australia are fantastic too. They give you that space and that time, but they're also quite high-end online products now as well. So there's been this kind of wonderful evolution back to slow journalism, I think. I still feel like there's a place for me.
And you also had a journey back to politics in a way with your first novel, Challenge. So tell us how you approached that project and what kind of research it involved.
That was unfinished business for me, really. I felt like that was something I just couldn't possibly do in nonfiction or in journalism. I really wanted to write a story about what it was like to be inside a politician when all this shit was coming down on them, which it does every day. And I mean, there are so many reasons to hate politicians, but when you're up close and personal with them, you realise that they withstand an awful lot of pressure, you know, in terms of public and political shame, but in terms of the personal stuff they go through, in terms of juggling a private life with that incredibly toxic public demand, the expectations are inhumane, really. I think if you were working anywhere else and you treated fellow workers the same way, you'd be subject to, you know, workplace counselling. You'd probably be sacked. But in politics, kind of shame is the most potent weapon out there. And these people kind of deal it and live in fear of it every day. I've still got two or three friends, or I did have in politics at that time. I never made a lot of friends in politics, but I did have a couple on both sides. And as part of the research, I spoke to them about the prosaic stuff, like what it felt like to be under pressure from the whips on a day when, you know, a leadership vote was going down. Your wife in Melbourne or the Northern Territory suddenly comes down with appendicitis, the air conditioning breaks and the school rings and says, you've got to come and pick up your kid because your wife's in hospital. You know, how do you kind of juggle that stuff, the human stuff? So, yeah, there was no archival research involved. It was just human.
But you're one of those rare writers who seems to be able to slip effortlessly between fiction and non-fiction. Do you think that there's an appreciable difference between the quantity and the type of research you have to do to write a work of history compared to a novel, say the novel you're writing now?
Sure. Effortlessly is a generous take on it. I find it pretty hard, actually, but it's something I always wanted to do. It's a bit of a left brain, right brain thing. One thing it does have in common is that the novel I'm writing currently is really heavily research-based. It's archive-based, actually. My instinct in writing books, with the exception of Challenge, because I didn't need to, has been to, as a starting point, to run to the archives. Maybe it's where I feel safe. I don't know. I always know I'm going to find something and I know it's going to set me on a different direction. So with the book I'm doing currently, with Jesus Town as its working title, I won a creative writing fellowship at the National Library, and the National Library had a fantastic collection of papers belonging to the 1948 US-Australia scientific expedition to Arnhem Land. There was one guy in there, an American called Setzler, an anthropologist who I loathed as soon as I kind of started reading anything about him. And I knew if I went to his papers, I was going to find a character in there. So that's where I went, and it's been really instructive as well as sort of on-the-ground stuff. And with all my other books, Canberra and even the Collingwood book involved a family archive. Yeah, I've just always been directed in a way by what I've found.
So how have you known with Jesus Town that this is a novel and not a non-fiction book?
A, I didn't want to write a non-fiction book, and B, having spent a little time in the north, and even though I'm sort of not naming it as a place in the book, I kind of wanted a way to convey the magic that I didn't feel like I could convey in a nonfiction. So dealing with issues like complex spiritual beliefs and, you know, foundation myths, I think it's stuff which as a white fella you can't even really understand, like magic and sorcery. I felt like I needed fiction to make that work. You know, I've been through a lot of drafts with this book. I'm on the final one at the moment. And the trick for me was to not let the historical archival research sit too heavily in the narrative, to just let it sort of instruct it, to tease it through it. But yeah, I think had I decided to write nonfiction, I'd just never finish it. It would go on and on and on. You know what it's like up there.
Never ending.
Yeah.
Well,
Aboriginal history is, of course, the focus of a lot of your journalism at the moment, with you writing the post-colonial column in The Guardian and several other essays on that theme. A lot of those columns are really heavily researched and talk in quite a lot of detail about archival objects.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in how you think that kind of deep research in archives, what's the role for it in journalism? Like, do you see, as a journalist, you have a role to be kind of engaged in public history practice as well?
I do. I mean, I'm in an unusual position, I think. I really walked away from journalism for a few years, and I was drawn back to it somewhat reluctantly, but kind of almost by mistake when Guardian started. The founding editor, Kath Viner, wanted me to write a couple of pieces about Australian history, about the frontier stuff, because as a Brit, she felt like she was more conversant with it than many Australians were. Yeah. As a progressive Brit, that is, you know, conversant with the sins of colonialism. So I did a couple and that turned into this thing. And, you know, it's a mixture of obligation to write about this stuff, which really isn't covered in mainstream media very much, although I think that's changing. I think more and more people are starting to look at it. I was just fascinated in it too. And, you know, it took a little while, but it connected me with all these amazing people who were working in the space. Academic historians and anthropologists and archaeologists, people who, you know, had dirt under their fingernails, who were getting out there with people and telling these stories, but really telling them to each other rather than telling them to a big readership. So I kind of felt privileged. They started coming to me and said, tell this story or tell that story. And I would do that. And of course, I always credit the research. And I see it as part of my job to illuminate this fantastic research that others are doing. Like, I don't call myself a historian, I call myself a writer. I'll take the source material from wherever I can legitimately take it from, so long as I can always give credit to the people whose work it is.
One sort of theme I've noticed in a lot of your historical writing in The Guardian is that a lot of it kind of seems to focus on or sort of take inspiration from material culture.
Yeah.
There's a lot of description of whips, of maps, of photographs, of statues. Is that a kind of deliberate choice? And do you think material culture has a kind of particular role to play in public history?
I think in the Aboriginal space, particularly because there was so much theft of material culture and so much of it is in, you know, white fella institutions, I really kind of feel the need to draw on that stuff and what's known about it, what Indigenous people know about it and have imparted to white researchers. I've always been very, very interested in writing about landscape, about natural landscape, about the sky and weather and trees. I'm also very interested in writing about urban landscape. And I kind of walked through this city for 29 years when I lived here without noticing all these statues. It wasn't really till I started writing about history that I started thinking about why the fuck are all these statues of white men there, you know? And who are they and what do they do and should they be there? So I started exploring that sort of stuff. Then buildings and nomenclature is another thing I'm very interested in as well. So, yeah, I think that's why I'm so interested in the material stuff.
Paul, I know you were recently in a room full of Indigenous bones. It was an archive of colonial destruction and desecration.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what it felt like? And also, what are you going to do with that?
So this is a collection, and I sort of hate to use the word collection in relation to it, but it's a collection of body parts belonging to 4,500 individuals. And it's in the storage unit out near the airport. Body parts became part of the collection in all sorts of different ways. Many of them were stolen from traditional grave sites. Many of them were frontier war victims. Many of them were sort of stolen from institutions too. There was a trade that went on well into the 20th century in Indigenous body parts. So I'd been in this room before, but not for a protracted period of time. The guy who's head of anthropology at South Australia is John Carty. He's a good mate of mine. And I'd been negotiating with him and the local custodians for a couple of years, actually, to tell the story of these remains. And as part of that, the starting point, we went back into that room and we spent, I don't know, an hour and a half there. And I sort of felt totally overwhelmed by trauma, actually, afterwards. The first time I did it was just a fleeting sort of visit. But this time I was really overwhelmed by the responsibility I felt, because I know that the John and the others who go in there often feel that same responsibility. So the responsibility to tell the story, to return identity to these people, to return dignity to them. So if you can imagine 6 or 7 rows of, you know, 1.5 metre high shelves packed with cardboard boxes with remains in them, that's what it was. I felt, you know, I felt like there was life in the room too. It wasn't a static feeling at all.
And are these remains going to be repatriated? Is this an archive that's going to be dissembled?
That's the idea. So the guiding philosophy for Indigenous stuff at South Australian Museum, the most conservative collecting institution in Australia, which now has the most progressive head of anthropology there, is to look at the collections and say, okay, why do we have 7,000 spears? You know, why do we have 3,000 shields, and what should be done with them? And okay, so the people want them back, but if they get them back, they'll return to dust. Well, they were never designed to last forever in any event, and they were designed with different purpose in mind. Giving that sort of material culture back is one thing. The human remains are really difficult to provenance. Some of them have individual markings on the bones. Some of them can be located to a space or a people, but not a specific tribe or group. And, you know, there's all sorts of issues associated with taking them back to the wrong place. And, of course, if they don't belong to a certain people, the people don't want them. The question then arises, what do you do with them? This is where the whole issue of a Commonwealth keeping place or a state-by-state keeping place becomes a real issue. And I've thought about it a lot and written about it a lot. And I have argued the need for a Commonwealth keeping place, but really you need state-by-state ones, because were all those remains to go to Canberra, for example, to a Commonwealth keeping place, they'd be further from country. That would make it less likely that they'd ever get home. But it's a really big issue, and it sort of tells such a story about our past too.
It's a big issue, and it's a really interesting question of the role of the historian, not just in using an archive, but in either assembling or indeed dissembling an archive. Mm. I know you've also been an outspoken critic of the Australian War Memorial as a collecting and exhibiting institution. What's the basis for your objection there? And can researchers afford to bite the hand that feeds?
Yes, they can. So there's been some kind of material from the Australian War Memorial collection that's been critical to, you know, at least one of my books. I never talk about discovering a document in an archive, really. Someone else has always seen it beforehand, but the material there that went into my book Bathsheba was about a massacre by Australian light horsemen of Bedouin and Arabs at the end of the First World War, and that was sort of a critical element of the book. So, of course, I'm appreciative that I was able to look at that and have someone guide me to it in that archive. But I've got multiple criticisms of the War Memorial as an institution, and not the archivists and the historians, of course, or some of the historians maybe, certainly the board. The first is the most recent, and that is the proposal to spend another $500 million on expanding it, which just seems to me profligate and crazy at the moment when there's such a stretch on for money in those other public institutions, you know, the National Archives, which holds all the war records, by the way, the individual service records, the National Library and all of the others. The other thing is that has really irked me has been the refusal of the War Memorial to tell the story of the frontier, the Australian frontier. So it wants to tell a foundation story about Anzac, an Australian National Foundation story. The invasion of an obscure finger of the Ottoman Empire in 1915, you know, a long time after 1770 and 1788. Yet it will not tell the true foundation story of white Australia, as far as I'm concerned, which was, you know, the frontier wars that killed anywhere between 60,000 and 120,000 Indigenous people and created the edifice for white Australia and its federation in 1901 and its first parliament, whose first acts were the White Australia Policy Acts. I don't think they can justify their refusal on the grounds that what happened here wasn't war either, or that Australian locally formed military units weren't involved. There were locally formed military units, and they overlook, of course, what to my mind is a huge and very difficult story, and that is the formation of the native police, which were comprised of undeniably locally raised, locally born people.
So has the War Memorial got a role to play in what might be academically called decolonising the archive?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think their position on this is ingrained at the moment. So the last time there was a vote on this, it was 13-2 against. So 13 people on the governing board were opposed to reconsidering the frontier war question, and two were for it. So it shows you just how far that argument has got to go. Yeah, they're responsible for decolonising it. I think the pressure is on. And I think if there's a change of government, there's likely to be kind of slightly more pressure. But I don't think until you get all those kind of crusty old military guys off the board, and they're mostly guys, anything's going to change.
And what about decolonising other institutions? You've also written at length about the Aboriginal remains held in the storage facilities of the National Museum of Australia.
Yeah.
In an essay in Mianjin a few years ago, you wrote how hundreds of these human remains are just sort of in limbo. Mm. Is there any movement on that front?
There has been some progress there, although not nearly enough. And it's a question of resources too, which is another thing about this war memorial spend that really, really irks me. So remains belong to 600 people in the archive of the National Museum. They did have one full-time person looking after them, that is trying to repatriate them. And that's a really complex process of anthropology and documentary research. So South Australia Museum, 4,500 and one full-time person. The intent is there, but governments really need to get behind the decolonisation of those collections particularly. A really interesting one at the moment, I think, is what's going on at ANU history with the Australian Dictionary of Biography. They do call it a decolonisation, and it's exactly what it is. It's sort of giving voice in that dictionary to people that are overlooked because of colonialism's ways, you know. Blackfellas, women who were, I think, 2% of the first three volumes, and also doing it properly so that when you talk about the Indigenous people who were notable at the time, you actually get their stories straight, rather than rely on colonial tropes.
Paul, do you think that historians and archaeologists and political scientists and other academics who rely on archives are doing enough to weigh into this space, to be activists, essentially? Or do you think it takes a kind of journalist's drive like yours to come back to that kind of gotcha moment where you actually want to see an outcome, you want to influence the course of events in some way? Are historians doing enough?
Not really. I don't think it's for lack of will. I think the right people want to see change. They're not always sure how to do it. I'm not sure that academic historians and anthropologists speaking to other academic historians and anthropologists is going to change it. So in a way, journalism's kind of a handy vehicle. So with the ADB, like I'd been criticising them for years without ever really thinking about who ran it. And one Sunday I wrote this kind of scathing article about how the ADB had overlooked all these slavers, you know, these guys, pillars of South Australian society who'd made all their money through slavery. And it was an academic historian who'd brought this to my attention, Clinton Fernandez, but then I kind of whacked the ADB for it, for overlooking it. So suddenly I had, you know, Frank Bongiorno, who I know really well and like a lot, going mental on Twitter. I engaged him over it and kind of said, look, let's work on this together. And so the next piece I wrote was about how much money they needed, why this needed doing, you know. So, yeah, come to me and I'll
So do you see your role then as sort of, in a way, translating this kind of academic research and highlighting its political implications in the present?
Yeah, I think I do.
Yeah.
You know, I get emails, phone calls from academic and public historians every day, you know, with story ideas in this space. You know, I can sort of do so much or pass them on. But, yeah, I do feel like, having kind of bitten this off, that's what I need to do. And seeing change is fantastic.
And what kind of change have you seen or do you hope to see?
I really want to see the incoming Labor government stomp on this $500 million that's been earmarked for the War Memorial. I really want an incoming Labor government to actually look at this situation of the keeping place seriously. So a committee of Black and white people sent a report to government 5 years ago now, and the government has not responded to it. This is on the need for a keeping place. So I really want to see that happen. I want to see the other public institutions funded properly for digitisation. And it's great to see something like the will driving change at the ADB, for example, without them getting a funding boost to do it so far. But I think that'll be looked at too.
Paul, apart from being saviour of the universe, I know that you you do spend a lot of time in archives and always have, obviously. I'm going to wrap up by asking you a question that we ask all of our guests here in Archive Fever. Is there a dirty little archive secret that you have stashed away that you've always wanted to confess?
It's a safe space.
Wow. Do I want to confess it? So this is a journalism archive story. So the senator I was talking about, who I wrote about many years ago and won a couple of awards for it, was a guy who held the balance of power in the Senate, Senator Mel Colston. He was a Labor defector. I knew that there were documents around that would prove that he was corrupt. In order to get them, I had to convince a prominent Labor Party figure to cut a hole in his roof and pull a box of documents out of his roof to give them to me, because he'd hidden the documents up there for a rainy day, knowing that his colleague was corrupt. This is the way politics operates. And he'd renovated the house and there was no manhole, so he had to cut a hole in the roof to get him out, which he did.
Did you pay to fix the hole?
No. But I did scalp the guy.
So it's a historic hole now.
Yeah, you could just take that whole thing and put it in a museum.
Well, it's in my archive.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us here on Archive Fever today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
No worries. Thanks.
To learn more about Paul's work, you can follow him on Twitter at @PDaily.
And you can also follow his column Postcolonial in The Guardian.
So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri's sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
This has been the final episode of Archive Fever for Season 1. We hope you've enjoyed it.
Until next time, see you in the archives.